Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, I'm coming home. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your grace turn blue, grace turn blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care and I won't let go. Even oceans away, you're with me day by day. Memories of you keep flashing through my mind. The very thought of you makes my time. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine.
If not in May, then you'll see me in June.
Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your grace turn blue.
Welcome to another special episode of Your World News, and this is a really special episode because we're partnered with the Nibiru Cultural Center's radio program as well, UNITV Radio, and they have their own media outlet that I'm really happy to be a part of. But we're partnered with them today for a special broadcast that's merging the two strengths and energies of these independent radio stations together to bring you a special edition that's going to be focusing on the culture, you know, and how culture and acceptance is built within societies, specifically looking at the glorification of historical figures that are quite you know, unsavory to say the least. And you know, one of the individuals that we're going to be focusing on this edition is going to be none other than Cristobal Colón, you know, otherwise known as Christopher Columbus. And you know, joining us, you know, in a few minutes, we're going to have an iconic figure, Dr. Howard Zinn, will be joining us. You know, he'll be with us shortly, and when he joins us, he'll be talking about some of the many, many books that he's written, including People's History of the United States of America, which, in my estimation, should be when American history is taught, that is one of, if not the textbook that should be used in every single U.S. history class in America from coast to coast. And so we'll be talking to him about Columbus, about the culture and acceptance that are built in to the fabric of any society. And in this case, we're looking at society in America and how, you know, it's become acceptable to celebrate, to have a holiday. I mean, you know, this holiday's been around for a little while, the celebration of Christopher Columbus. And you know, for those of us who know and those that don't know, Christopher Columbus was an awful, awful, awful human being. Was a genocider, murderer, of course, mutilator, rapist, plunderer. You know, he exercised these things, all the things I just named, through his men, himself, all in the whole under the auspices or the umbrella of European conquest into the so-called New World. And we know it was only a New World to European explorers that were coming, you know, that were coming from the East or into the Western Hemisphere. And you know, we know that, you know, well over, you know, for thousands of years, there are people that were inhabiting throughout the entire Western Hemisphere, indigenous peoples, you know, Taino, Kono, Arawak, Carib, you know, and on and on and on. So we're going to be exploring that with Howard Zinn, and we're also going to have, you know, some special call-ins from individuals such as Nefta Freeman, who is a strong activist in the Washington, D.C. area, and has been doing a ton of things, and we're going to have a conversation with him. So, but to kick this whole mood off, I think it's really appropriate to go with another track. We opened up with Mama Africa by the late, great Garnett Silk, and I want to get a little local flavor, and so I'm going to go with a track that really embodies the whole mood of this show and the whole topic that we're going to be exploring. And this is a local artist by the name of Head Rock. And this was a track that he released a few years ago, simply called Columbus. Listen very, very closely, because this is the kind of music that would do wonders if it was played on radio stations and on video shows across America. But it's not, because it's controlled by the corporate media. And the corporate media would rather play music and that quite frankly upholds a lot of racist stereotypes and images. And so they play stuff that is geared towards commercialism, that is geared towards misogyny, sexism, that is geared towards drug uses, drug selling. Those are the kind of artists. So if you carry that kind of message, you have a much greater chance of getting played on a mainstream airwave or having your video featured on a mainstream television station, as opposed to putting out something that sounds good, that's also culturally edifying, that's educational, that's knowledgeable, that is laced with critical thought. And so, but I want you to listen to this song. This is called Columbus by Head Rock.
Chris Columbus, the man of his time, slaughtered Arawak natives to further his kind, and they stayed of mind. And their take on the divine allowed them to be so inclined to send ships with guns, filled with men with swords, so filled with the love of the Lord that they do whatever's necessary for their position. Death is the decision when they on a mission. Death is the decision when they on a mission. What we talking about? Imperialism. Death is the decision when they on a mission. What we talking about? Yeah,
imperialism.
Not every second Monday in October, we hold a celebration for a Western soldier.
who brought over a culture manifestly destined to rule and take over. Funny how in the name of Jehovah, you're supposed to be the landowner, more so than the first holder. Ask the natives of Plymouth about the caravan next to the boulder. From what they told ya in high school about righteous concepts, brave explorers, little revealed by the millions killed with the government will try to seal up the horror. Hey, the superpowers locked in the chest back, the cool cat is this back, to see who is this back, to this back, to this back. Promote all the tax, we give tax plus 10-4 crack. Now tell me what you think about that. Do it sound familiar to me too, cousin, I feel ya. And all because I picked up a book and looked and was looked by the ditchy crooks and looks. Chris Columbus is the man of the time, for the Arawak made is the furthest of kind, and they say the mind is there, they want to divine, allow them to be so inclined, to send ships with guns, deal with men with swords, so deal with the love of the Lord, that they do whatever's necessary, but they position, justice is a decision, when they on a mission, justice is a decision, when they on a mission, what we talk about, imperialism, justice is a decision, when they on a mission, what we talk about, hey, but not long after the shock of being enslaved, recovery efforts are made to educate the people's afraid, terrorized in a way, diabolical, physical, psychological, part of an economical interest, an ill-fated role in attempts of humanity, ultimate sin fest, the obliteration of race and a savage little path to a civilized way, mixed and made gold, revived the great ghost, given new lingo, plus Chris Gringo, decimated families to say those meaningful things. And the sugar plantation, kids on the road for freedom. Hit them drugs, it's time to beat them. He's about the blood, dead for the love of who we are. He's on the road, he's Chris Columbus, the man of the time. So the Arawak made it the further of kind, and they say the mind. And then they go to define, allow them to be so inclined. To send ships with guns, filled with men with swords. So filled with the love of the Lord, that they do whatever's necessary. But they position, that's the decision. When they on a mission, that's when they on a mission, what we talk about? Imperialism. That's the decision. When they on a mission, what we talk about?
Yeah.
Guns don't kill people. What? People kill people. Yeah. With guns created by people to kill people. These the words of Winchester and Brother Magnum. Time to lock and load, tag them and bag them. It's what we teach in them in class, son, with the most sophisticated weaponry imagined. Pull out the wagon,
in the heat stack em.
And if they friends aiming for revenge, then attack them. Check it, you're right to bear arms. This
criminal
is conflict resolution.
So that was Head Rock. He's locally based artist in Washington, D.C., and those who are part of the underground hip-hop scene know very well about him, and so that song was Columbus, and that is, imagine if that song was played over and over and over every single day, the same way, you know, these other songs that are laden with senseless violence, that are laden with misogynistic imagery and lyrics, the same way those are played every day. If you had songs that really infused a critical element in terms of looking into and questioning history and historical figures that have been fed to us, you know, since elementary school, and even before elementary school, you know, you get caught up in going to the Thanksgiving Day parade, and there's no real dialogue about based around, you know, what is Thanksgiving? What is Thanksgiving? Where does this holiday come from? It's one thing to use the holiday to celebrate, you know, getting together with your family, friends, loved ones, and so forth. But when the holiday when part of the holiday's story and lore has to do with you know, the so-called, you know, peaceful settlers, you know, European settlers, you know, coming from, you know, landing on Plymouth Rock and you know, the whole lies behind that, and not talking about what was done by Governor William Bradford, you know, in terms of how he waged war and killing spree on the natives that were there in what became known as the Massachusetts Bay Colony, but we're talking about Pequot and Narragansett and those indigenous people there. The story is it's like a horror film, and that's seldom taught, you know, and that's, and you never see a float, a one of those you know, those big floats that you see coming down Broadway, you know, in New York when they have the Macy's Day Parade and so forth. So anyways, you know, as I said, in a few minutes or in a few moments, we'll be joined by the great Howard Zinn, who is an author. He has been a political dissenter for a very long time. He is a professor at Boston University. He's a playwright. I mean, he's done many, many things. And he actually just wrote recently wrote a piece that we're going to have a chance to discuss with him, and where that piece came from. And his piece has a lot to do with how cultures are created, you know, in terms of the celebration of figures from folks that, you know, have been given these prestigious awards, such as Nobel Peace Prize, such as folks like Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt. And we're going to be exploring, you know, that award and how it's been doled out and handed out to folks. So I think we have a caller on the phone, and I'll take this one call real quickly as we wait for I see Dr. Zinn has just joined us, and so I want to patch him through because we have a limited amount of time with him. Dr. Zinn, are you with us, Howard Zinn?
Yeah, I'm here.
How are you doing? How are you doing? I this is Solomon Kamajan from Your World News and UNI TV Radio, based on the campus of University of Maryland. It's an independent radio station that is centered throughout our cultural center, and we've got a lot of students that work on the program, that work to put it together, and they created their own media outlet based on their disgust with what the mainstream and corporate media does not talk about and what it omits. And so they wanted to really, you know, use their creative talents to really get the truth out and get their own perspective out. And so you're welcome. We welcome you. And I was just telling our listeners, gave them a brief biographical sketch about your history as a political dissenter, as a playwright, as an author. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to have you open up the show by kind of having you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and how you became a political dissenter, because I understand that, you know, you used to be, you served in World War II as a bombardier, and I heard an interview with you with David Barsamian, and it was really, you know, it was kind of just like really refreshing to hear how your transformation came about after you got back to the States after World War II. So if you could talk about that and your history as a political dissenter to kick the show off, I'd really appreciate that.
Oh, okay. I'll see what I can do. I'll try to live up to what you promised. It's not that I entered World War II as a person who believed in war. In fact, I had been very much influenced before World War II by anti-war literature, by the literature that followed the First World War, and that portrayed the First World War for what it was, and that is one of the most stupid wars in history, among stupid wars. And so I had read Hemingway and Dos Passos and Erich Maria Remarque, All Quiet on the Western Front, and this is as a teenager. I read Johnny Got His Gun by Dalton Trumbo, a very powerful anti-war novel. So, no, I was anti-war, not really expecting to become a bombardier in the Air Force, but the rise of fascism in Europe, the aggressions of Hitler, Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, you know, all of that made me think that it was important to defeat fascism. And so I enlisted in the Air Force in World War II with that one aim in mind, the defeat of fascism. Now, what happened is that, and I was an eager bombardier, you might say, you know, and so I bombed places in Europe and Germany and Czechoslovakia, Hungary, even France. And it wasn't until after the war that I began to rethink the whole question of what I had accepted without question, and that is that there is such a thing as a good war, a just war, and, you know, the war against fascism looked on the surface to be, you know, a just war. But when I looked back on World War II and I saw that our sides, the good people as opposed to the bad people on the fascist side, when I saw that our side had committed atrocities in the war, that we had matched Hitler's bombing of civilians with our own bombing of civilians. In fact, outmatched him in the bombing of civilian populations and cities in Dresden and Frankfurt. I mean, in Dresden, we don't know how many were killed, you know, 80,000, 100,000. You know, Kurt Vonnegut in his book Slaughterhouse-5 gives you a kind of a glimpse of the horror of the bombing of Dresden. So we killed perhaps 600,000 German civilians. Now, these are not Nazis. These are civilians. These are Germans, you know, who are part of a fascist regime, just as Americans were part of the machine that put us into Vietnam. And if somebody had come along and bombed American cities during the Vietnam War and said, well, it's justified because your government has invaded Vietnam, well, we wouldn't think that was just. So I went over that experience, the bombing of German cities. And then, of course, there was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I did a lot of research into Hiroshima and Nagasaki because everybody was saying we had to do that to end the war against Japan. And I discovered, no, we did not have to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki to end the war against Japan. The war against Japan would have ended. It might have taken a few months, but it would have ended very soon. In fact, the official report of the Strategic Bombing Survey of the United States government, they went into Japan and interviewed all the top Japanese leaders right after the war. They came to the conclusion that there's no question, without the dropping of the bomb, Japan would have surrendered. So here we had killed a couple of hundred thousand people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Before that, a few months before that, we firebombed Tokyo, something that I think most Americans don't even know about. In one night, we killed probably 100,000 people in Tokyo. So when I went over this record of our atrocities in World War II, and if yes, the Germans had committed atrocities, but what's the point of saying that you're fighting a just war if in the course of the war you begin to resemble the enemy? And I came to the conclusion that war poisons everybody who engages in it, that you start off being the good guys and they're the bad guys, and then you gradually turn into the bad guys, because that's what war does. War corrupts everybody. War distorts people's thinking. War creates fanatics on both sides. So it was that revelation and that after the war, the thinking, studying after the war, that led me to become an opponent of war, of all wars.
Thank you. I really appreciate that answer, because I recently read, and if I can get your comment on this, I recently stumbled across an article that you just wrote, I think this past week. And, you know, it seems like nothing, you know, when you talk about the naming of wars as being the just war, it seems like what's going on right now in Pakistan and parts of Afghanistan in terms of the indiscriminate bombing and usage of manless drones and even airstrikes throughout, you know, Afghanistan and various parts of Pakistan, it seems like this has been labeled as the just war. And we just saw the naming of the Nobel Peace Prize by Barack Obama, who has, since he's been in office, has sent out many of those, you know, has ordered many of those manless drones. And so if I could get your opinion on the Nobel Peace Prize, because it does have a history of naming folks like the rabid racist, you know, beyond other things that he was responsible for. Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
You know,
oh,
he showed Birth of a Nation to the White House, and Teddy Roosevelt. You know, those kind of unsavory characters. So what's your opinion on the Nobel Peace Prize, and also the recent naming of another U.S. president as the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, frankly, I was taken aback. I was really, I thought this was absurd. To give Obama the Nobel Peace Prize? Well, yes, absurd, but of course, it's just one, and you pointed this out, it's one in a line of absurdities. The Nobel Peace Prize has sometimes been a joke. By that I mean, the Nobel Peace Prize has been given in the past again and again to people who had broken the peace, to people who were militarists, people who initiated wars. I mean, the Nobel Peace Prize was given to Woodrow Wilson. Now, why? Well, yeah, true, Woodrow Wilson had, you know, was responsible in good part for the League of Nations, which after World War I was an attempt to prevent war. But in fact, in Wilson's presidency, he had been a warrior. He had sent warships to bombard the Mexican coast. He had sent an occupying army into Haiti, in the course of which several thousand Haitians were killed. Sent an occupying army into the Dominican Republic. This was around 1915, 1916. This was, you know, during his first term. And then, of course, he takes the United States, after promising that he would keep the United States out of World War I, he brings the United States into that war. And as I said before, World War I was the most grisly and inexcusable wars in history, a war in which 10 million men die on the battlefields. And at the end of it, no one can figure out why the war was fought or what good it did to the world. So Woodrow Wilson is given the Nobel Peace Prize. There's something really absurd about that. And then, of course, Theodore Roosevelt was given the Nobel Peace Prize. Theodore Roosevelt, who is a lover of war, Theodore Roosevelt, who is part of the invasion of Cuba in 1898. I know we learn in our history books that, you know, we went into Cuba to liberate the Cubans from Spain. And in fact, there's a half-truth, maybe a quarter-truth to that, and that is that we did get Spain out of Cuba, but that didn't liberate the Cubans, because now the Cubans were under our thumb. We replaced Spain as the power controlling Cuba. And Roosevelt was part of that process. He was an imperialist. Roosevelt, as president, supervised a very bloody and brutal war in the Philippines, a war that lasted for years to subjugate the Filipinos, to prevent them from running their own country. Roosevelt, at one point in that war, he congratulated a general, an American general, right after the American general had massacred his regiment under his command, had massacred 600 Filipino villagers. These were people living in some other age who had no modern weapons, and the American army just poured firepower down into them, killed every single one of those villagers, men, women, children. And Theodore Roosevelt sends a telegram of congratulations to the general, says this was a great military victory. I mean, and Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, gets the Nobel Peace Prize. So the Nobel Prize Committee has a record of absurdity, a record of giving prizes to people who are the opposite of what a prize winner should be. Well, Kissinger is the most recent example. Kissinger got a Nobel Peace Prize. Why? Because he was in Paris and signed the treaty that ended the Vietnam War. Yes, but he had been one of the architects of the Vietnam War. He had been an advisor to Nixon. He had gone along obsequiously with everything Nixon did, the bombing of Cambodia, the bombing of Vietnam, the carrying on of the war. Kissinger was a warrior. Kissinger was a war criminal.
Yeah.
There are countries that Kissinger will not go into because he's afraid that in those countries, I think Spain is one of them, that he might actually be brought into court and tried as an international war criminal. So Kissinger gets the Nobel Peace Prize. And so here we are. In that sense, I shouldn't have been surprised. You know, I said I was, you know, I was dismayed and taken aback when Obama got the Peace Prize, but I shouldn't have been surprised because this is the way Nobel Peace Committee, the prize committee, has been behaving. And why does Obama get it? Because he's a smoothie. He's a rhetorician. He's eloquent. He promises peace. He talks peace. He talks against nuclear proliferation. He's a great talker. But what have his actions been? As you pointed out, almost as soon as he came into office, he sent these unmanned missiles, Predator missiles, to bomb Pakistan. And we've been bombing Pakistan ever since. We're not at war with Pakistan. Pakistan is a sovereign country. I mean, if this thing were done by Hitler or Mussolini, say, oh, you see, that's what fascists do. They just go ahead and bomb another country at will. That's what we've been doing with Pakistan. Now, hundreds of people have been killed in Pakistan. Hundreds of civilians have been killed in Pakistan as a result of these Predator missiles, and they're still going on. That was one of Obama's first acts when he came into office. And, of course, we all know, that while he promised to withdraw troops from Iraq, he's withdrawn a few troops, a small number of troops, and in the meantime, he has sent more troops to Afghanistan. There's no sign that we are getting out of Iraq. There is a sign that we are ensconcing ourselves more firmly in Afghanistan, which certainly must be one of the most stupid things that we could do in foreign policy. Afghanistan is a country that has been smashed to bits by the foreign powers, by the English, by the Russians, and now by us. And those people deserve to be let alone. And we instead continue to bomb them and continue to kill people in Afghanistan. And when did this start? It started after 9/11. And George Bush used the pretense of, doing something about 9/11, doing something about terrorism, a pretense, because there's no way an invasion of Afghanistan, bombing Afghanistan, is going to stop terrorism. Just the opposite. It will increase the number of terrorists. Because, you know, terrorists are created by anger against certain policies. And American policy in that part of the world, by its brutality, by its aggression, has provoked enormous hatred. And when you provoke hatred among millions of people, a small number of those people will become fanatic in their hatred and turn to things like 9/11. And so to respond to 9/11, yes, to an act of terrorism, by bombing, invading Afghanistan, in other words, by another act of terrorism, because after all, war is terrorism, you know, it's self-defeating. And Obama has continued that. Instead of Obama becoming president and saying, you know, that was wrong. That was not the way to fight terrorism. we have not eliminated the problem of terrorism by bombing Afghanistan. We had better change our foreign policy. No, Obama did not do that. Obama is a very traditional president, which means expansionist, militaristic, and did not deserve to get a Nobel Peace Prize.
Not at all. I couldn't have said it better, and I really appreciate the piece that you just wrote recently. I read it early in the morning, or late in the evening, I should say, Friday evening. I was just really moved by it because, you know, a lot of what you said was bounced around my mind when I woke up and I found out that he had won the Nobel Peace Prize. And to me, it builds in a long legacy of the U.S. glorifying, you know, war criminals and also glorifying intolerance to and disrespect to other cultures in general. And so, you know, as we embark in less than 24 hours, we're going to embark upon a federal holiday that, quite frankly, you know, places on a pedestal and worships a war criminal, a plunderer, a rapist, a mutilator by the name of Cristobal Colon, otherwise known as Christopher Columbus. You know, and one of the books that I read years ago, you know, in the 90s, that really opened my eyes to Columbus, because I was never taught about the real Columbus. I had to find out through alternative sources. You know, even there were some rap songs I listened to growing up that talked about the real Columbus, but never in school. In school, you know, he was celebrated every second Monday of October, and there are these things about him. And so one of the books that really opened my eyes to him was your book, People's History of the United States of America. And you know, I'd like to get your feedback about not only Columbus, but what really drove you to write this book, because I've referred a great number of students and colleagues of mine to use this book, to read this book, and to use this book in whatever classrooms they occupy, even non-conventional classrooms that may occur within somebody's house as a tool to teach youth, because otherwise, and I think you were alluding to this, otherwise, if this same trait, if this continues on where we have this complacency, where people just kind of just go with the way, you know, these, you know, so-called powers that be push us, we're not going to see any change in society. As a matter of fact, it's going to continue to digress. And you know, as Dr. King said, if, you know, to paraphrase him, I can't remember the exact quote, but he said something along the lines, if you know about evil that's going on and you do nothing about it, if you don't speak out against it, you are as culpable as the people that are carrying out those evils. And I see your book as one of those great many moments in your life that you have been that dissenter and spoken out and been that inconvenient hero. So if you could talk to our listeners about Columbus and also, you know, about your book, People's History, and what kind of precipitated you to write that great work.
Well, thank you for what you said about the book. And well, I was led to write People's History of the United States because I had gone all through a very traditional historical education. I mean, not just as an undergraduate, but I went to graduate school at Columbia University, got my PhD in history, but that was my major. And afterward, when I looked back at what I had studied and at the books I had read and the lectures I had heard, and I matched that against what I myself knew about the real world and what I was learning day by day about the real world, I realized that the history that I had gotten in school, which meant the history that all Americans got in school, that history was enormously inadequate, that history glorified conquerors and war makers and people with money and power, that history looked at the world from the standpoint of the people on top, the presidents and the congressmen and the Supreme Court and the generals and the industrialists. And what was omitted from that story was what ordinary people had endured, what the Native Americans had endured as the European colonists drove violently across the country, what black people had endured, what working people had endured, working in the factories and mills and on the railroads and so on, what women had endured as, you know, absent from major documents, absent from the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, you know, the Bill of Rights. And as I looked at all these people, 95% of the American people omitted from history, whose interests were not considered, whose point of view was not considered, I realized that there was room for a history of the United States that would look at American history from the viewpoint of the people who had been overlooked, and the people who had fought back against their oppression, the anti-slavery people, the anti-war people, the rebellious women, the Native Americans who were trying to resist the encroachments on their lands. Their story, the story of the people, that story was missing from our history books. And so, you know, I decided to write it. I think one of the things that prompted me was that at the time I made that decision, I had come up from the South. I'd been living in the South, been involved in the civil rights movement. And when I was involved in the civil rights movement, I realized that the real story of that movement, of the grassroots people, of the black people in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, the black people who were both victims of racism and also who fought back against it, that story was not being told. That the American people were getting, they were getting a story of some of the big events, you know, the sit-ins and the Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King. But there's an enormous amount of grassroots activity of rebellion in Albany, Georgia, in Selma, Alabama, in Birmingham, Alabama. All of that, what black people were doing to change that condition, that was being ignored. And when you ignore what ordinary people do, you're left with the thought, oh, well, if anything is going to be accomplished, it's going to be accomplished by the president or by Congress or by the Supreme Court. It'll come from the top. But the fact is, and this is what I learned going into history and what I learned experiencing the making of history in the South, is that when change comes about, important change comes about and some injustice is remedied, it is not initiated by the government, not initiated by the important people. It's initiated by citizens themselves who organize and who resist, by the anti-slavery people and the labor movement, the working people. It's the ordinary people who insist that we have to get out of Vietnam. And these are the people who are crucial in trying to create a better world. So these are some of the elements that went into my thinking when I began to write a People's History of the United States.
Thank you. And any comments on just the ongoing celebration of Columbus Day?
Oh, well, you know, I think there may be a couple of states that are not celebrating Columbus Day. I think maybe North Dakota has created Indigenous Peoples Day to replace Columbus Day. I know there have been protests in the past in various states against Columbus Day. But, you know, I think the celebration of Columbus Day is something that people should reconsider. Why should we celebrate a man who mutilated and killed and kidnapped Indians who destroyed the civilization they had in the Bahamas? He was, you might say, the first imperialist of the Western Hemisphere. Why are we celebrating the birth of imperialism? And so I think it's very important to reconsider all of that. I would suggest that teachers get in touch with a group in Milwaukee called Rethinking Schools, which gives out a lot of literature about Columbus, or a group called Teaching for Change. You know, these are organizations which give materials to teachers which are unorthodox, the kind of materials that you don't see in the traditional textbooks. So, you know, we all need to re-educate ourselves, and and rethinking Columbus Day would be a nice beginning.
Definitely, definitely. And for my last question, I'd like to ask you, you know, a very pointed question in terms of, you know, you've seen a lot of change and been a part of a lot of change within the scope of the climate of not just this country, but the world in general. And, you know, unfortunately, we see some of the shifting, you know, backwards in terms of in some social issues. It's kind of absurd right now when we look at, you know, the whole debate around healthcare. We have no qualms as a country, no qualms, you know, and I when I say we, I'm not saying everybody in general, because I know there's a lot of people that are fighting valiantly to try to get every American to have universal health care, and so that we don't have these tens of thousands of people that die each year because they don't have health insurance. But we spend, you know, 600, you know, some odd billion dollars, you know, last year, on track to spend another $667 billion, you know, by the own, you know, WhiteHouse.gov's website themselves, saying that their military budget for this year is 667, and that's what they're saying. You know, so we can say it's probably more than that. But we have no qualms spending money to kill people in aggression. It's going to be the Department of Defense. It's more like the Department of Aggression. But when it comes to spending, you know, a pittance of that to ensure that people actually live, it's really indicative of a society. You know, and I've talked to some colleagues of mine that live in Canada in different parts, and they say it's just surreal to watch this go on. That, you know, universal healthcare is something that's been a part of their fabric for some time. And the question I wanted to ask you is what do you think the prospects of change? What as a society? What are some of the things that folks on the ground, regular people on the ground, because you've been at the center for a long time? What are some of the things that we have to do to really push to invoke this change? Because the true masses are the people that are on the ground. They're not the masses are not those elites that are on Capitol Hill, you know, writing these bills that change our lives. Yeah. Like, you know, what do you think has to be done?
We have to educate people, because the media are not educating them. I mean, fortunately, we have little alternative media, you know, radio stations, programs like yours, programs like Democracy Now! Or the Radio Pacifica, you know, David Bassamian, alternative radio. We have some alternative sources of information, but mostly information is controlled by the major corporations. And so what we need is to really spread accurate information. Tell people, a lot of people, maybe most people, don't even know what health systems are in Canada, in Norway, in Italy, in Germany. They simply don't know that there are health systems that give free health care to the whole population without signing forms and going through insurance companies. We need to do a lot of educating. And at the same time that you educate, you organize. You organize the people who are being re-educated, and, you know, and you begin to create a social movement. And you don't give up. You don't feel helpless, because what you do is you recognize that the people who have power, they only have that power because of our obedience. When we withhold our obedience, they don't have power anymore. So, yeah, there's a lot for us to be done, and we mustn't get impatient. Just keep on, keep on keeping on. Well, look, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I'm so glad you are doing this alternative radio work. It's part of what we need to do in the future. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
I appreciate your time, and on behalf of the students and faculty and staff and administrators that work for the Nibiru Cultural Center. I want to thank you for all the work that you've done and how you've dedicated your life towards really making a change. And you know, we really appreciate that, and we will keep on keeping on.
Okay. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. That was the great Howard Zinn, and, you know, that was, you know, some powerful words from you know, one of the elders in this society that has really you know, transformed a lot of people's lives through his work, through his literature, through his plays, through his words, through his political dissenting. And you know, we have a caller on the phone. I think it's one of my esteemed students. And I you know, before I introduce him to the program, I just want to say that those are listening right now, it really is incumbent upon us not to continue to go with the way the wind blows. If any of what Dr. Zen has introduced to you today, or anything that I've said that is new information or has moved you in any shape, form, or fashion, it's really incumbent upon you to really take it to the next level. Don't just let that information reside within you. If you didn't know it, somebody else out there didn't know it as well. And so you have access to people within your family or what have you, and you know, regardless of the fact whether they may be caught in inertia or just whatever, you know, it's important for us to continue to spread this information and to continue to mobilize, organize, and work tirelessly to create a better environment for those young folks that are out there right now that are children, adolescents, you know, infants that are 8, 9 months old, just learning how to walk. You know, that's why we do this work. You know, it may not be the change that we may see in our lifetime, but for God's sakes, you know, we need to really push forward, you know, on behalf of those children that are out there right now that are just learning, you know, picking up things day by day in terms of what society is. And if they're picking up through their elders, through their parents, their big brothers, their aunts and uncles, that it is okay to speak out against injustice, that you know, the celebration of Columbus is unjust in and of itself, then you know, that in part and parcel is part of change. You're changing, you know, people's psyches, their subconscious, their conscious, and you're instilling them with something that is invaluable, that you know, no amount of money can purchase, and that's the ability to dissent, speak out, and speak on behalf of oppressed, dispossessed peoples, you know, wherever they may be. And so without that notion, Anya was on the line. He's a senior at the University of Maryland, College Park, has been a long-time community activist, if it's possible to be a long-time, you know, community activist at age 22, 23. But as long as I've known him, he's been at the forefront on campus in terms of student groups, student activist groups that are doing things. He's been getting out into the community. He's done work in the Oakland Bay Area against the prison industrial complex. And so, Des, I want to get, you know, with the time we have left, what is Columbus Day? What does it mean to you? Because we have to spit fire at this day, because this day it's absurd that most of the states within, you know, this union, you know, so-called union, you know, celebrate this day every single year, and it's taught in schools, and kids are taught that Columbus was a great explorer, this, that, and the other, with no mention of the nefarious things that he did to end people's lives. What does this day mean to you, and how did you learn about Columbus, and what changed your whole outlook on in terms of who he actually is?
That's a very good question, Solomon. To me, Columbus Day essentially means the beginning of the end of African and, you know, American, Native American civilizations, you know. When 1492 hit, you know, that's when the Europeans had, you know, basically kicked a lot of the Africans out of Europe. You know, Spain had been controlled by the Moors from Northern Africa for a good 800 years, and, you know, they kicked them out, and they started their assault on not just Africa, but the rest of the known world. And so that really marks the beginning of the end for the rest of, you know, the civilizations of the world, and the beginning of the rise of, you know, Western hegemony.
Yeah, you're right. And that's it's never placed into that context. And why do you think it's not placed in that context? Why when, you know, people that are administrators within these school systems, you know, some of them do know the truth. Some of them do know the truth, but continue to push this, and you know, there'll be some, you know, I've met some of them, they'll be some of the biggest defenders of Columbus Day, and you know, come on, why are you putting this in students' heads? And I'm always like, are you trying to destroy their lives? And they're like, lies. I'm like, these kids' lives. I said, by you putting this into school books, you're trying to destroy their lives because you're limiting their lives. When you have children growing up worshiping somebody like him, you're taking a big piece of out of their soul towards humanity. You're removing humanity from their soul, because humanity, you know, I think that when you have the ability to empathize and have compassion for people who died needlessly, such as so many, you know, Lakono, Taino, Carib, Arawak, indigenous folks did at the hands of Columbus and his men, you know, you're not going to celebrate this man's life as you vanguard through life, and you have compassion for other folks, and I think that centers you closer to humanity. And you know, so why do you think it to this day, 2009, there have been protests across the board, the information's out there, why is this still alive and well in the good old US of A?
Well, I think for the most part, Americans and white people as a whole, they live in denial. I think for the most, you know, they really think that what they've been doing is okay, that it's all right to go and attack and mutilate and destroy whole civilizations, and you say that you're bringing them civilization. I think that's really what the key thing is. They're not going to say that what Columbus did was a crime, because they don't see anything wrong with it. That's part of their mission, you know, the so-called white man's burden. You know, when it came into Africa to civilize the so-called savage African tribes, and, you know, that's when African civilization came to an end. And Native Americans, you know, a lot of times people talk about the Holocaust, and 6 million Jews died. And although there were a lot more people that died besides the Jews, but that's beside the point. In America, I mean, I don't even know how many Native Americans lost their lives. You know, hundreds of millions might have lost their lives here. And, you know, all they get is, like, you know, some reservations, you know, stuck hundreds of miles away from their homeland. They get derogatory team names like the Washington Redskins and things of that nature, named after them. And on top of that, to add insult to injury, the person who basically started the whole thing is given a holiday every single day. And so I think for the most part, like I said before, white people are just in denial. They have no clue what they've done, and that's why they're unapologetic for it.
That's real profound words. Real profound words. I'm glad you mentioned the Washington football team's name, the Redskins. I mean, that is, in essence, that's like referring to it's so acceptable. I mean, it's just it's disgusting, and that's why, as long as that team has that name, I will not be going to any game, you know, in that stadium played by them. That's like referring to a team like that's the Chicago Niggers or the Chicago, you know, Blackfaces, you know. So I'm glad you brought that up. Dest, I know that you have a program, and before we get off air, I'd like you to let our listeners know what is the how can they tune into your radio station on Blog Talk Radio? What's the address for that?
Oh, okay. I do a radio show with my brother, Akobondo, and it's actually twice a month, and it's called Igbo Kwenu Radio. And Igbo Kwenu Radio is a pan-African radio show. It's aimed mostly at people of Igbo descent, both in the diaspora and on the continent, but it's open to, you know, all African people, because we talk about African issues, talking about culture, history, politics, a lot of things that they're not going to talk about on other stations. And actually, to get to it, all you need to do is go to www.blogtalkradio.com/Igbo Kwenu. And Igbo is spelled I-G-B-O, and Kwenu is spelled K-W-E-N-U. www.blogtalkradio.com/Igbo Kwenu.
Thank you, and definitely tune into that, because, as you know, the history of people in this world started in Africa. it started in Africa. You know, the first civilizations can be traced back to, you know, 200,000 years ago, and then we see, you know, civilizations, you know, on the western part of the African continent. So in essence, everybody on this planet is African. So you need to tune in, because that's world history. That's the start of world history. So Desta, I want to thank you so much for calling into the show and giving the folks your web address for your radio show. And I want to also thank you for being at the forefront, for making sure that the work of your ancestors, like, you know, Kwame Nkrumah and you know, Dr. King and Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey and Ida B. Wells and Sojourner Truth, you know, making sure that their work was not in vain, that you're carrying on the baton, because they did all that work so that you could continue to carry the baton and continue to forge the way ahead with so many other folks, to make sure that we don't stop until there's absolute equality, you know, across the board, not just a little bit, not just, you know, symbolic equality or this and that, but real, tangible equality that reaches out to folks and those folks who have had that equality stolen from them, you know. So thank you so much for that work, and thanks for calling in, Desta.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. Show.
Oh, you know, it's my duty. It's my duty, as it is yours. So thank you. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to Your World News and UNI TV Radio. Like I said, this will be rebroadcast tomorrow on UNI TV Radio. And so, you know, please make sure that, you know, you pass this link on to your friends, you know, because, you know, we spend a lot of time passing links on to these senseless, you know, e-jokes and stuff like this, but we need to start passing on tangible, like, information that is really concrete, that's going to help folks. So pass this link on, and definitely check out Desta Aniwo's show and pass that link on as well, because as I said before, African history is world history. So it is all of our history. So and that's the way we need to continue to reframe these discussions, is that it is world history. It is world history. So anyways, take care, and we'll see you next week with another episode of Your World News.